I mean, is it weird that we like criminals?
No, not in romance.
Welcome, everybody, to Faded Mates.
It's an existential question for our time. Actually, you know what? Here's what I want to talk about before we talk about anything, which is some, you know, people who say you cannot have or find interesting discussions on Twitter are wrong. And one of the most interesting threads I have read recently was by a woman named Fangirl Genie. I don't know if you follow her.
I do follow her. I think she's very, very, very smart.
Oh, God, yes. Like, the kind of smart where you're like, oh, you're so smart, and I like being smart, but you're really smart.
Yeah.
And she had a really interesting thread, and I will link to it on show notes, about essential, and she, and I, what I love about her is she, I think, must read enough romance to be really familiar with the genre. And this is not really a thread about the romance genre, which she makes really clear, but I still think it's really applicable to what we're going to talk about today, which she said, you know, it cannot be that happily ever afters are only for good people. And she talks about how, you know, like, if you only essentially deserve love if you are in your perfect state, that there's something, like, really wrong with that. And that she talks a lot about TV and, like, movies in this thread about why she loves, like, villains who fall in love. And it's this really fascinating thread. And one of the things she says is, like, you know, that and I, like, the whole thread is, like, honestly brilliant. But she said, you know, the idea that being in love only makes you do good things is crazy. Because she, or is, you know, she said, in fact, people will often do terrible things for love. And so that we shouldn't tie love to essential, like, moral goodness. And I just think the whole idea that, like, when we talk about anti-heroes in romance, I think we're really trying to explore, like, the limits of that. And you and I were not talking about Nazis or Stasi officers.
No,
or
that is the limit.
Confederate that's soldiers,
off the,
right?
Off the, no.
That's no, not you. It for us, right?
Klansmen, we don't want any of that business.
No. But I think what we do want is, I think we do want to know that there's happiness, even for people who are imperfect. And you can sometimes explore that with people who are really imperfect. And often in romance, that's heroes and not heroines. And I want to talk about that too.
So, yes, I agree with that. And I agree that we can't expect people at their best to find love. But I do think that the anti-hero plays a really important part in the sort of fantasy of love being able to transcend everything, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because often the anti-hero isn't just like sort of regular old bad guy, right?
Yeah.
He's bad guy who has done the heroine dirty.
Yeah.
And like that is about, there's something sort of like perversely about forgiveness in that. There's something about being able to have, being able to have like guilt or penance, sort of deliver love in some way. The grovel is really critical
tied into
in
this.
These books. They don't work without a great grovel.
Oh yeah.
And then there's also this, like, complicated question of morality chain, right? Because most of the time, I would say probably almost all of the time, it ends with the hero transforming to good, right?
Yes.
They don't end up still terrible.
Well, I think there are lots of romances where they do, but I don't read them. Right. I mean, and that's okay. Like, not everything is for anybody. And one thing that's really interesting to me is when I went to sort of remind myself, like, right, like, what are books that I've liked with this? I did a couple different searches and I find, like, Goodreads lists to be really helpful for this,
same,
right? If I'm
same,
trying
same.
To, like, jog my memory. So I'm like, romance novels with criminal heroes. And it's like 800 pages. Romance novels with criminal heroines does not exist. Romance novels with like criminal couples or pairings is like 2 pages. And the gender dynamics of that I think are really interesting too, because women, when they do end up being like sort of lawbreakers, it's like they're jewel thieves, right? Or they're con artists, maybe like Vika.
They have to have a good reason. heroes have to have a good reason too, but here's the thing. A hero's reason can be he comes from a broken home or like he had a terrible childhood. A heroine's reason has to be her sister is hungry or her mother is dying. Like it has to be, it has to put the heroine into savior space.
Right. And I think that that's something that I find really interesting because, you know, I just think the unwritten ways in which like the like gender is like enforced in romance is something is right. And you know what? Like part of me is like, that to me is the anti-hero thing really, I think, triggers a lot of this, like me questioning like why that is.
And well, it also becomes when it comes to gender, right? The anti-heroine is really too often described as the unlikable heroine.
Yeah.
Right?
And she's often, in that case, it's not that she's a lawbreaker, right? It's that she isn't obsequious enough. Right. Right? I mean,
or she doesn't have a noble enough, or it's nobility too, right? Like an anti-hero, like I say all the time, okay, heroes have to be kings. Like and I stand by that. Like heroes do have to be kings ultimately. But they don't have to be good kings, not to start. Although well, here's the thing. They do actually have to have, there's that like old adage that like any romance hero ever like has to be willing to run into a burning building to like save a basket of puppies. Right? Like there is an inherent nobility required for a romance hero. And I agree with you. I don't read these books, but there are a lot of books out there right now where that's not the case. Like, and I'm not here to kink shame, but it is an interesting question. Like, it's the Simone scale, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, at what point does it cross over into, where does it go from crazy to wrong, from wild to wrong?
Yeah, like I think that's a real pertinent question for us in 2019. And it doesn't surprise me that we're like trying to work through this in romance, because I think romance is always trying to work through some things. But I find myself wondering, like, are we trying to justify like the current course that many Americans like seem to be on right now? Right? Like you could still, I don't know. Like, I don't know how to say that. It's like really hard. Like, right. Like we've got concentration camps for children on our border right now. And so what does it mean to like make heroes who are like anti-heroes and stay anti-heroes?
Right. But I also think that I think there's something really interesting here, right? Because you and I have said like no Nazis, no Klansmen, no slave owners, no like we've made the list, no Confederate soldiers. Like these are just these are people who we can just X right off the list. Like I tweeted, you know, last year, right around this time, like somebody out there is writing an ICE know, officer romance. Don't. Stop right now. Like, that is not a character who needs to be redeemed. Like, and I think that there is a level of fantasy required for these books.
Yeah.
I think about Sky Warren a lot. So Sky writes, you know, really dark romances. Yeah. And I was recommended, like, she has a series, it's like the king, the queen, the prince, like it's got chess. And you know, there's rape in it, there's the hero is the, you know, the hero of this book is incredibly dark and like broken, and like the first book is their childhood, where, you know, she's kidnapped into this place and he's his father, I think, is the owns this like world and is like a master criminal, and he sort of has to save her, but it's not really saving. It's a kind of, it's real tragic. It's a lot of, like, the books are very, very, Skye knows how to write a book. I mean, she is a magnificent writer. But these books are dark, and they are tragic, and their happily ever after is hard won. I mean, this is partially because the books end on cliffhangers. Like, it's a series, so you really have to deeply commit to these books.
Yes.
And I think about, like, the work that that book does. Like, he's incredibly rich. He's still a criminal. She comes back to this world. Like, he sends her away to Smith to, like, go to college. And she returns. And he's so furious with her for coming back. Right. You know? For, like, he gave her this, like, opportunity to leave. And then he treats her terribly. And still they fall in love, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's so much, and I do not want to call this dub con or non-con, right? Because that's not what Skye writes. What Skye writes is dark, like, intense emotional romance, like, with these sort of incredibly complicated relationship dynamics. But there's also a huge amount of dub con, dubious consent romance, non-consent romance. Out there right now, and it is certainly doing work. And I think you're right that it's doing some kind of social work. Like, it's doing some kind of work, like, iterating a society.
Have you ever I'm not a big watcher. We've talked about this, but have you ever seen the movie Traffic?
Yeah.
And a really interesting, like, character evolution in that book or that movie is with Catherine Zeta-Jones, right? Mm-hmm. Where she, like, essentially at the beginning is completely unaware that her husband is essentially, like, a drug kingpin. And he, I think if I'm, like, remembering correctly, like, gets arrested and she figures it out. And romance watcher me was expecting her to essentially, like, straighten up the family and fly right. And instead, to protect her family and her lifestyle and their money and their home, she essentially, like, runs the business for him. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of shocking for me, but I also think it was silly of me to feel that way, because the idea that somehow, like, women cannot, like mm-hmm. be, like, right, like, women are just as capable as anybody else of essentially, like, deciding that, you know, protecting their money or their lifestyle or their kids or whatever it is more important than, like, the law.
Yeah.
And well, right?
That, I mean, Traffic is the dark version of it, but the lighter version of it is Weeds, that show with Mary Louise Parker, whose husband dies and she's a stay-at-home mom. And she's, like, they live in this, like, McMansion in California, and, like, she has to make do, and the way she does is by selling weed. And then, you know, like, by season four, she's, like, traveling across the border and married to a, like a drug kingpin.
Yeah.
Like, and it's one of those situations where, yeah, like, you accept it, and in that case, it's sort of, like, a funny, like, the first couple of seasons of Weeds are, like, hilariously funny. But the truth is that, we don't expect heroines to behave in such a manner. And we don't treat them the same way we treat heroes.
Right. Well, and I think it's also really important to point out that, like, these dilemmas are often among, like, white characters where, right, like, sort of the
rich,
influence
rich
of,
white
people, yes, white, like, when rich white people sell weed, it's not funny. Yeah, it's funny, right? This is, like, a clever comedy, because the stakes for that character are never going to be the same. And I think that that's one of the things about, like, you know, dark romance. It's, you know, like, I do read some of it. I mean, we talked a lot about, like, in 2019, it feels like romance readers are kind of polarizing. You know, you either are really drawn to, like, soft, like, cinnamon roll, like, right, you just want things to, like, feel really comforting, and so therefore the characters you read are are softer. And then there's like a group of people who are like, no, I just need to read about the darkest things because I need to know that like there's light at the end of that tunnel.
Yeah, you can transcend them. That's me. I mean, like I want every dark romance there is. But some stuff is too dark for me, right? Like, yeah. I think Nikki Sloan is – we've never talked about Nikki, I don't think, on the podcast yet, and I would really like to. We need to figure out a way to do an interstitial where I can talk about Nikki. But Nikki Sloan writes these, like, really terrific romance novels that are – you know, these erotic romance novels. But she wrote – and I said – I had sort of always said I'm not on board for non-con. Like, I don't want to read it.
Yeah.
And I was recommended her non-con novel, and I read it, and I could appreciate sort of intellectually, as somebody who reads a lot of romance novels, I could appreciate the right, like, she's a brilliant writer. Like, I could appreciate so much about it, but it just, like, it was not for me.
That's not for you, but other things are, whereas I'm sure we're going to talk about things today where, you know, some readers will be like, oh, that's not for me, but this is, because I feel like the pocket that you're, like, getting that from is, it's, like, just really different for everybody. Just like the good happy stuff, right? So I do think that this is, but the pitfalls feel, it just feels riskier to, like, go into one of these books not knowing what you're getting into.
Yeah.
Right?
That, I just want to name check that Nikki Sloan book. It's Sordid. That's what it's called, Sordid. In case you're interested.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that's the part that's, like, really interesting is like, what does it mean to be exploring this as a reader? What does it mean to be exploring it as a society? And then, like, knowing that there are limits to it, right? Like, these are, you know, what does it mean? I mean, I talked a lot in a Rita thread about how, like, anti-heroes are almost always in romance or, like, white guys, right? You know, like,
sure,
right? And that's not something we even, as a genre, have figured out how to give people, how to give anybody but white men, right? Like, women can't be anti-heroes, people of color. I mean, and that's something I think that, I don't know. Like, I'm always like, I don't know what to do about it, except say that it's there.
Now,
right?
I just said it out loud. And that's the best. Yeah, that's, I mean, it. That's the way you start, right?
Right.
I mean, I think a lot about unlikable heroines, and I'd like to talk. Maybe we should, I'd like to do an interstitial about unlikable heroines because I love an unlikable heroine. But certainly, I've read books. I've written books with heroines who readers cannot deal with, like, cannot stand, and that is because, you know, they are, like, I think, you know, we talk about it all the time that heroes just get a pass, like.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about, can I talk about my first book? Because I do think this is a good example of, like, heroes just getting a pass. So my first book is actually, it's the first book in a series called Dangerous Royals. It's a mafia series, right? Like, we've just come off of Cressley's mafia series, where actually we talked about it in the player episode with Kate, but the professional is really the only one where he's, like, truly a criminal.
Yeah.
Although Maxim has his, like, you know, whatever.
Yeah. I'll talk more about that when I do mine next. So yeah, keep going.
So, like, so we have this, like, you know, so, but mafia, certainly, like, there was the rise of the mafia romance, like, back in the day. Cressley was writing them right around the same time as everyone else. Like, she sort of rode that mafia wave. But Annika Martin wrote a series called Dangerous Royals, and the first one is Dark Mafia Prince. It's followed by Wicked Mafia Prince and then Savage Mafia Prince.
I read them all.
I know, me too. And so the first book is essentially the heroes, it's three brothers. It's going to sound very similar. Three brothers who were supposed to become, like, they were supposed to inherit this, like, mafia kingdom in Russia.
Right.
This is Russian mobsters. Nobody's an Italian mobster anymore. It's very sad. But these are Russian mobsters.
Just go watch The Godfather, Sarah.
It's true. I'm showing my age. So the, essentially, the their father and had a best friend, had like a consigliere, and they were like equally, they were best friends, and these families were raised together. And then suddenly the father was double crossed by this friend, murdered, and then the entire like mafia world that the father was king of is now like became owned by the best friend, right?
Yeah.
The best friend, of course, has a daughter. And so when these boys who were squirreled off into hiding, grow up into strapping, handsome young boys, they return to take their revenge. Everybody knows I love a revenge story, to take back what had been once theirs, and to do it fully punishing the friend's father or their father's friend by kidnapping with the intent to like torture and kill,
yeah,
the heroine, who is his daughter. It's a whole lot, this series.
Yeah.
Like, they hate, I mean, he kidnaps, the Alexio kidnaps Mira, and she is like, she has been working, she remembers him from when they were children. They were like friends when they were children. I mean, we also know that I love a childhood friends to enemies to lovers story.
Yes.
And so this all like sort of works out perfectly, except for the fact that like he can't do it. He immediately sort of falls back in like into love with her, remembering her from childhood, and like can't like follow through. So there's a second brother in this series who like in the moment of the first book is like, fuck this. We said revenge. That means revenge. Like,
yeah.
And like he runs off to Staples to buy a paper cutter to like cut off her finger and send it to her father to like prove. And like there's this whole back and forth that Sophie Jordan and I had over text while we were both reading this book like voraciously, where we were like, because he doesn't take the finger, you guys. She doesn't get her content warning. She doesn't get her finger cut off. And Sophie Jordan and I were like, this is terrible. Like, he needed, that second brother needed to take the finger. That's like, so that you know, our Sophie Jordan's and my text messages back and forth are often like, I don't think I can do this. Like, this piece of the book is too hard, or like, maybe it's too crazy or too bananas. And the response will be, take the finger after these Annika Martin books.
That's amazing.
But basically, like, so he's an anti-hero. Then we get into the next one, which is Wicked Mafia Prince, where the heroine is in high, like, he's done the heroine completely wrong and like threatened her life. And so she is in hiding as a nun. And he like goes to find her in the convent and abduct her in like a vengeful way. And then the third one
is like the one that's like so bananas.
Third brother's missing through the first two books. And they can't figure out what's happened to him. They don't know what happened to him. Turns out he was feral and, like, raised by wolves. He literally walked out of the forest and was, like, this, like, feral character. It's a bananas series. Like,
yeah, it is.
Bananas. But more importantly, it is real anti-heroes. Like, there's nothing about these guys that is noble in any way, except for once they fall for their heroines.
Sure.
There is nobody, like, they cannot be, they protect them with every ounce of their being. It's true morality chain.
Oh, for sure. Books. Especially that last one. I mean, it's not just like, I need to bring you back into society, I'm your bridge to society. It's like, I'm your bridge to humanity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's pure, that one, yeah, it's pure morality chain. But there's, I mean, there is a place, like, we've talked about Morality Chain before, and listeners have asked us to recommend them. This series is probably the closest. Anytime you look at an anti-hero, you're toying around with Morality Chain.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because ultimately, like, they can't, also remember at the end, like, they're still criminals.
Yeah.
And so you do sort of have this piece where it's like, they're still mafia. They just now are kings of the mafia, and which, you know, okay. And then on top of it, there's this sense of like, they're good they're maybe a little less sadistic because now they're in love.
Slightly.
Yeah, a pinch. A pinch less sadistic. I mean, I gotta say I love these books. I read them all.
Sure.
1, 2, 3, back to back to back.
Oh, me too, for sure.
And, but I think, but it, I'm sorry, it goes back to this fantasy thing where it's like, I don't want real life with these books. Like, I wanted him to take the finger because I was like, that feels totally bananas. Like, I want this to be, you know, this is a 10. I want it to be an 11.
Yeah, right. I want it to be 1100, right? I mean, it's...
And,
well, and I think in that case, there's not even any nod to it being anything like reality, right? So it's easier to divorce, you know, it's easier to divorce my sort of like, I don't know, is that right? Because you're like, no, it's all, right? Fine.
I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, you can unstitch, like, your like, the fabric of reality and, like, just live in your little world in a way that you cannot with Nazis. Like, Nazis fucking exist, and I don't want to read about them. But, like,
no.
You know, this guy walked out of the forest like a feral grown man and, like, suddenly becomes a romance hero, and that feels completely implausible, and so I want to read a book about it.
Absolutely. Doesn't he, like, basically recognize her from a coma? Oh, is that the one?
Yes.
And I was like, that is some powerful...
She's doing... Like, she's a researcher. No, she's a reporter masquerading as a researcher, obviously. And he's so... Everybody on staff thinks that he's, like, in a coma and not thinking. But, like, it's basically Conrad and Naomi. Like,
yeah.
And they see... Like, she sees him see her, but no one realizes that he sees her.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's amazing. It's Fated Mates.
Fated Mates. Annika Martin.
I mean, it's a nonsense book. Annika Martin, I love you, but it's a nonsense book.
I don't know if I have mentioned my favorite Annika Martin books are The Kinky Bank Robbers.
What? Wait, is that the tree? It's a threesome. No, it's a...
Yeah, well, there's three men and one woman. And
she's
bank
a bank
robbers.
Teller?
Yes, and they rob her bank, and then she runs off with them, and they all call themselves by god names. It's like Odin.
Yes. And what is
Thor?
Do they call her?
I think it's not Isis.
Yes,
Isis. And they
I've never met Annika Martin, but you are bananas, and I love it. That's my highest praise.
I do too. Okay, so let me talk about one that this, and it's like a really, you were like, that's an interesting choice, but it's Moonlight Scandals by Jennifer Armentrout is the one I want to talk about. And this is the third book in a series, and I think this is the best one. Jenny Nordback loves book number one because there's this like hint that these two brothers are going to do this one girl together, right? She was like, wait, I didn't know I loved that,
Jenny,
but I do.
Any time that, you know.
Yeah, it's real sexy. So the hero of this book is named Devlin. Devlin DeVincent. And it's very like Southern Gothic, right? Like they live in Louisiana in this big mansion and the house is haunted. And they are, like, of course, billionaires. And here's what I really liked about this book. Okay, so the heroine's name is Rosie. She's, like, the best friend of one of the previous heroines. And so that's kind of how she comes into his orbit. And she's actually, like, a ghostbuster. Like, she and a couple of people essentially, like are trying to discover if ghosts really exist. And so these two literally could not be any different. And part of the reason I really actually have a lot of respect for this book is it is the only book I've ever read where it is pretty straight up that, like, the way you're a billionaire in America is that you've done some dirty fucking shit. And your ancestors did some dirty shit and you did some dirty shit to keep it. And that is what you have to do if you want to stay billionaires.
Yep.
And I love that because I feel like it's so different from the like, oh yeah, I'm just a 27-year-old billionaire because I work really hard.
Yeah,
like,
I work super hard.
Right? Come the fuck on. No, it's not. You're a billionaire because America is trash and capitalism is terrible. And Devlin is essentially this like in the first two books, this like real cipher. This house is big. The brothers all live. So it's, you know, the previous books are his brothers. And, you know, this is one of those books where I was like really excited for book number three, because I was like, how are you going to write this dude as a hero? Because he's such a jerk. But, and then you're like, can you pull it off? Right? It's sometimes that third book's really hard to pull off when you've really set up that third guy to be. I don't know
anything about
any of this. I'm sure you don't know anything about this. But here's the part where I was like really all in is, Rosie is actually visiting her friend, and, you know, like, he's like, you need to move your car. You're blocking my way to the eight car garage or whatever. And so she goes out and he's sort of talking to her and someone calls her. And so she picks up the phone and he cannot believe that she's taking a call while she's talking to him.
Yeah.
And she shushes him. And he is like, she gets off the phone and he is like, I have never been shushed in my life. And he's such a jerk, right? Yeah. And it's honestly, he's so terrible to her because he is like so fucking mean to her, and she just gives it right back to him. And it turns out that he, in fact, has done some very bad things to keep his brother safe, to keep the family safe, to keep their money. Mm-hmm. What I liked about it is, unlike the Annika Martin books where it is completely bonkers, instead, I felt like this was, I mean, this, right, it's about ghosts and whatever. Like, there's some bonkers stuff to it.
This feels but, real compared to that.
Right, but the whole idea that, like, your billionaire family in the South is pretty dirty, and that the way you've kept that money is by, mm-hmm. like, essentially, like, being dirty politicians and, you know, doing whatever, mm-hmm. I found that part to be really honest. And I really liked that this was like probably the only romance billionaire I've ever read who was basically like, yeah, I've done some shit.
Yeah.
Don't shush me.
Don't shush me.
And yeah. She was like, how about you fall totally fucking in love with me and I wreck you? And I was like, yes, I would like more of that, please.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? Is there's... You also, it's the appeal of bringing down power. Like, the anti-hero only works, here's the thing, the anti-hero only works if he's undefeated, right? Because he needs to be defeated by the heroine. Like, the heroine needs to be the thing that destroys him, that brings him down. And so we can talk all the time. We have talked about Sophie Jordan's prison books. We talked about, like, I think there's actually a difference between a prison book, a prison criminal book, and a anti-hero. Like, I think, and I think the difference is the anti-hero needs to be that he is, like, that no one has ever been able to touch him. No,
I agree with you. But the thing I want to say about Sophie's prison books, because here's like a fun fact, is when I was in, I don't know if I mentioned this, when I was in college, I tutored in a prison as a class. Have I told you the story? So I feel like
you're like in that Kara McKenna book.
Not at all. I did not fall in love with anybody. That did not happen. But
sure.
It was... But I guess I felt like after that experience, I was very sensitive to the portrayal of, like, innocent white guys who'd been railroaded into prison. Like, I do not want to read that book. And one of the things I really greatly respected about Sophie's books is that they were not, like, wrongfully imprisoned, right? Like, they had all done the things that they had been sent to prison for. And I thought that was important.
Yeah, I think that that is important. And I think that's really revolutionary for now. I think when Sophie was going through writing those prison books, we talked about, you know, for me, the sort of seminal text of prison books is Judith McNaught's Perfect, right?
Yes.
Where it is exactly that. It's a movie star who's falsely accused of, or not falsely accused, but like, you know, framed for the murder of his ex-wife. And he escapes from prison and he abducts the heroine, but he's like really a great, like decent dude who's like friends with Glenn Close or Meryl Streep or somebody. It doesn't matter. Point is, and I actually really love that book, but the difference is he's like a golden boy who is deeply innocent and like proving his, he escapes to prove his innocence. He's, you know, you know, whatever, he's the one-armed man. It's that Harrison Ford movie, right? And so
The Fugitive.
Thank you, The Fugitive. And so I think there's this really interesting thing where now in romance we are allowing ourselves access to these dudes who have done the bad stuff. And I don't know if that's contemporary coming out of paranormal, like the rise of paranormal post 9/11 gave us all these guys who had done bad stuff. They kind of had to. They had to be willing to kill.
Yeah.
Right? And here's the thing. We had military romance before that, but you couldn't really linger on the idea that, like, military heroes also killed. Right?
Yeah,
because, like, you can't, like, there is, like, the military hero is sort of Teflon.
Yeah.
But, like, a paranormal hero could still fight the big bad, but also have this, like, sort of edge of bad boy. Like, he was both military and pirate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then paranormal sort of started to wane, and these sort of particularly indie contemporary, and we should talk about that too.
Yeah.
These kind of indie contemporary started to fill that void of like pirate.
Yeah.
Paranormal bad guy.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting, you know, especially because, and we'll get to it when we get to my pick. But my other pick, but like historical, has always allowed for these sort of bad dudes.
Right. Right. Well, and I would say the best redemption story of a man coming out of prison is Mia Hopkins' Thirsty. Mm. Where he is, like, genuinely, like, was basically, like, grew up in a neighborhood where he joined a gang. And he'd been in a prison for a couple years, and it wasn't anything real big. It's not like he was a murderer, but... And he's really trying to turn his life around. And, like, the amazing, like, dignity with which she, like, writes this character. There's nothing about him that is, like, a stereotype or that is... I just think it's brilliant.
Well, what's interesting about Thirsty, though, and we've talked about this before, is Thirsty does different... Like, Thirsty is, I think, a revolutionary book because it's the first time I've ever read a romance novel where the hero isn't a king.
Yeah. Right. And that's it. It's like but he is... But he's so good, right?
I mean, he's magnificent, but the...
Yeah.
Like, that fact alone sets Thirsty... Like, I feel like we're going to look back on Thirsty in 20 years and say, like, that started something that didn't exist before.
That book starts with him essentially, like, living in someone's garage.
Yeah, the heroine's garage. I mean, which also breaks a whole second rule, which is, like, the hero needs to sustain himself. Like, the heroine can't care for the hero.
Yeah.
At the start. But...
Well, it's her mother's garage, right? Or something, right? It's like something like that. But it ultimately she lives doesn't in the matter.
House. I mean...
She lives in the house, right? And I just think that to me, though, was like such a... Like, I don't know, like the way that he thought about himself and his future and his past and the way that he's really like trying to turn his life around. I mean, I just thought like this is a... When we talk about like redemption in romance and... If you ever want to talk about redemption and romance and you are not going to talk about Thirsty, I'm like, I don't know what you're doing. It is the pinnacle to me of that, like, really a person saying, I want to change my life for myself.
Right.
And therefore, I'm going to find the right woman, not because I'm changing for her, right? I was already determined to change.
Well, he is, I mean, that's the thing, right? That's the only reason why that book works.
Yeah.
Like, because if it worked where, like, he was living in her garage and then he met her and he was like, I'm going to change for you.
No, it would never work.
It would just, it's just not, there's nothing about that it doesn't feed any of the fantasy, right?
Right.
But that book he is not an anti-hero by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, not at all.
Like,
not
there's nothing about that book. Actually, I think one of the things about that book that's really interesting is I think it actually begins. It's one of the earliest texts in the genre where we start to see this sort of edge into fiction. And what I mean by that is literally literary or commercial fiction, because right. the story isn't fantastical at all.
No.
It is a very authentic representation of redemption.
Yes.
Right? And in a way that, like, none of these other books are. Right?
Right. Absolutely.
There just isn't. Like, it just has none of the hallmarks of a classic romance novel.
Which is probably why it will be a classic romance novel.
Yeah, which is what makes it so important, I think.
Right.
That said, it doesn't... But getting back to it, like, we have this sort of... Something is happening, right? Like, and I do think maybe I've struck on something with the downturn of paranormal brings this sort of, like, upswing of these kind of wild indie contemporary stories filled with anti-heroes. And we talk all the time about the fact, you know, I remember having a conversation a million years ago, like in 2015, with my editor about why these indie contemporaries were working so well for readers, and her saying, like, they really echo that kind of, like, darker old school feel, that sort of, like, impenetrable hero who has to be unlocked by a heroine. There's something very traditional about these books, remarkably.
Yeah.
Right? As much as we're like, we don't know, like, what are they doing? Like, they're doing the work of, like, the early historicals, right? Yeah. Clayton Westmoreland. No. What the hell's his name?
I think it is.
Is it Westmoreland?
I think so.
I don't know. The hair. Jen, look at me.
I'm like, I don't know.
I'm holding it in front of me. Clayton, literally, you guys, this is how good we are. I literally have a copy of Whitney My Love on my desk. It's Clayton Westmoreland.
Of course it is. I was like, yes.
I mean, like, if you want to talk about an anti-hero, Clayton, like, beats Whitney. I mean, like, we haven't talked about the fact that, like, these sort of actions are very old school.
Yeah,
right. And lived on in historical for a long, long time. And we still in historical see these sort of, like, dark, impenetrable heroes who, like, don't want to talk to anybody, and they're very gruff and, like, you know, you know, they're kings of their world, right? Like, I'm writing criminals right now. So my pick is a book that I urge you all to immediately purchase. It's Anne Mallory's One Night Is Never Enough. And this book came out, I mean, oh my God, I think Anne Mallory is one of the greatest historical writers ever. She doesn't write anymore. She left writing historicals. Mm-hmm. I think she left writing romance altogether. But this book is from 2011. But, like, if you want to talk about writers who are unsung in the genre, who have done things that are really curious and interesting and, like, never write the same book twice, Anne Mallory has to be on your list. Like, she wrote 10 books for Avon, all historicals, and every one of them is remarkable. She wrote heroes who suffer from migraines. She wrote a paranormal regency where you're not actually sure if the hero's alive or dead for the whole thing. Like, there are a lot of, like, weird... She's written a lot of what I would refer to as weird books. Like, but she writes a beautiful sentence, and I have never not read one of her books in one sitting. Like, when I start an Anne Mallory, I finish it.
You're
that,
in. Yeah.
That day. So this book, One Night Is Never Enough, is the first book, I want to say, in this series. Essentially what happens is there's a king of London's underworld, Roman Merrick. Nobody ever turns him down. He's incredibly powerful. He has access to information about everybody. And he sets eyes on this perfect, like, debutante and she is the daughter of, she's the daughter of an aristocrat. He is, and she is like, she's beautiful. She is smart. She is funny. She is life of the party girl. She could basically have anybody she wants. She is a diamond of the first water.
Oh, and he I love is that.
Basically like a monster. Like, he lives in the darkness. She shines in the light. Right. And so to get her, he manipulates the shit out of her father. And because he owns a casino. So he basically says, like, come and play in my casino. And he runs her father into debt to the point where, like, he can only, like, he can only make a sex deal, essentially. Yeah. And basically he said, it ends up being, like, I will wager 10,000 pounds. Like, the father is wagering and wagering and wagering. He's in debt to 10,000 pounds.
Yeah.
And the hero says, I'll see that, I'll play you this round and clear your debt. If you win, if you don't win, I get one night with your daughter.
Yikes.
So he wins her in a game of cards. And then she is forced to be with him for a night. And
wow.
It is so amazing. Because basically what he says, she's basically like, no. You can't do that. And yeah. And he's like, fine, then I ruin you. Like, then I tell everyone that we were together and they'll all believe me.
Yeah.
And she's like, fuck. Like, so, and he's like, but if you stay with me for one night, no one will ever know. Like, all I want is one night. So she's like, okay. So she agrees. And all he wants to do with her is play chess.
Stop it.
I mean, no, that's not true. He wants to do it to her.
Of course he does.
There is, at one point, you guys, I looked up from my book and I was like, I have been reading this chess game for like 60 pages and I never want it to end. Yeah. They play chess in his bed. Like, and at the end, she's like, so are we gonna? And he's like, nope, that's your night. And he sends her off into the world. And she's like, wait, what? Like, and it is fucking magnificent. Yeah. It is, like, I say all the time, like, I always say, like, I have my five top romance novels of my life. This is one of them. It is so good. Buy it now. Buy it now. Find me on Twitter. Tell me I'm wrong.
Well, fight you know me. What? I'm not going to tell Twitter. You you're wrong. I'm not going to fight anybody. That's
you
not
guys,
what we're here for.
It is bananas. He is so wild about her by the end of that night that he is wrecked by her. Like, he cannot deal with how he feels about her. Like, he fully intends to just fuck her and leave her, and instead they play chess and it ruins him.
Oh god, I love that when they're ruined. I mean, right, so that's the thing, like, right, like, the tougher they are, the harder they fall.
Yeah.
Does he, like, drink for a long time after?
Because god, it's just so destructive. And he has a brother who's like, you're a fucking idiot. And then the brother has a book too. Obviously.
Of course.
I mean,
obviously.
Clearly.
Okay, that sounds amazing. They just play chess. Oh my goodness. Okay. All right. Let me tell you about a little playing chess of my own. No, I'm kidding. In this last book I want to talk about, which is by Molly O'Keefe. It's called Burn Down the Night. And one of the things I just want to say, I have nothing but respect for Molly O'Keefe, because Molly O'Keefe is so, like, so she actually has three different pen names. She has Molly Fader, she has Molly O'Keefe, and then M. O'Keefe. And if it's Molly Fader, you know it's basically, like, almost women's fiction, right? Like, it's going to be, like, romantic elements. If it's Molly O'Keefe, it's just, like, mainstream contemporary romance. And if it's M. O'Keefe, it's basically like erotic romance. And I love the fact that her branding as an author is so clear. And that she, like, and here's the thing too, like, she knows what she's writing and she knows what she's delivering to her audience. And she makes it so easy for you as a reader to, like, know what you're getting. And in a world right now where I feel like those lines are getting really, like, mixed up and people are like, yeah, I'm just writing this book. And you're like, wait, this isn't like any of your other books. And now I feel disappointed and maybe I shouldn't be, but I am. I've got to say, I want to just, like, kiss Molly O'Keefe if I ever see her, because I love the fact that she knows that readers have expectations based on previous books. That must be really hard. Authors, I'm sorry, but thank you, Molly, for being so amazing. Anyway, this book, Burn Down the Night, is the third book in the Everything I Left Unsaid series. And I famously said that I hate cliffhangers. The only cliffhanger I've ever read the second part of is Everything I Left Unsaid. Like, I read the first one and it stopped and I was like, oh shit, I must know what happens. I'm a real asshole. If you write a cliffhanger, I'll just stop reading. I'll be like, I guess that worked out for them, but I'm real pissed about it and I literally will not do it. This is the only time. And so in the first book, it's a couple and the hero's name is Dylan and his brother, Max. They grew up together, but his brother essentially went down a different path and got mixed up with, like, their dad's motorcycle gang. Now, motorcycle gang romances are, like, MC romances are real tricky too, right? They are, people love them. I secretly have read some, but I don't really feel proud of it because I feel like they're very problematic in a lot of ways. Just because I'm like, what are we doing here? And if we can't talk about what we're doing there, it's really tricky. But this is one I think that, Max, you can tell, we talked about this at the beginning, right? It's never really the life he wanted, but it was somehow this inevitability given how he grew up that he would end up in this, like, motorcycle club. Mm-hmm. And the heroine, though, and this is actually the reason I picked it, is not because Max is part of a motorcycle club. It's because the heroine, whose name is Joan, she's like the most fierce heroine I think I've ever read in any romance outside of Presley Cole. And she's a stripper. She's a con artist. She at the beginning of the book essentially plants a bomb outside of a strip club because she is trying to, like, corner this guy who, it turns out, has kidnapped her sister. And she is desperate to find her sister and get her back. And so, again, we have an anti-heroine, but there's, like, this reason for it. And in the process of, like, essentially trying to, like, get the bad guy and set off this bomb, she and Max is injured and she, like, throws him in the back of her car. He's been shot and she essentially kidnaps him because she's pretty sure that he is going to have information that's going to lead her to her sister. And this book is honestly, like, it's amazing. It's like this road trip romance, right? She throws him in the car and drives him to Florida. She knows she can't take him to a hospital because they'll ask questions about this gunshot wound.
Doesn't she go to her aunt? Or
she goes to her aunt, right? Yeah. Who is, you know, sort of this woman who, like, took her sister and her in at some point when they were, like, teenagers and was not very motherly, but, like, does take care of her. And I love to see a heroine who is backed up against a wall. Mm-hmm. And this heroine is backed up against a wall. And I think that it's fantastic. And I think part of the reason it really worked for me is because, well, okay, it's super fucking hot. Molly O'Keefe can write. I mean, I just think she's a really great storyteller. But Max, it's like about two people who never wanted to be living the lives that they're living. And so then when you get these two people together, it's like, how are we going to make it forward and make it through? And I think that that is what's really compelling to me, is it's a redemption story in some ways, but it's not about like erasing what they've done or who they've been. But, like, how do we, two broken people who fit together, move forward?
Yeah.
And I think that it's really amazing. And this book leads to a fourth book in the series, which I also really liked, called Wait For It. And at the end of this book, there's this really amazing line. And I'm not one to remember, like, lines. But Max sees the band will be the hero of the next book and thinks, Like, the animal in me could smell the animal in him. And I think that that is what, in anti-hero books, like, that sentence really sums up, like, it's really, like, you're stripping away, like, the veneer of humanity from people. Mm-hmm. And, like, seeing what's left. And I think that's ultimately what makes these books really interesting, especially because, you know, I right now am so comfortable in my life, right?
Right.
There's a way in which these books provide that. It's like getting on a roller coaster.
Yep.
Right?
And also, it because it's like getting on a roller coaster, it's also a really exciting ride when it's done well by virtue of the fact that you can't see how it'll end.
Right.
Like, you yes. you love a heroine backed up against a wall, like an anti-hero is a hero backed up against a wall. Like, their romance is backed up against a wall, right? Because
yes. she's...
Like, can you both be a bad fucking dude and love in a powerful way that puts yourselves first, right?
Yeah.
Because the end of result of a romance novel has to be a believable happily ever after.
Yeah.
It requires us to take a real ride.
Yeah.
And yeah. put our faith into authors. That they'll do it right.
Yeah. Well, and I think it also expansively allows us to think about what HEA really means, right? And, like, we've talked a lot about, like, the baby log, right? Like, the baby epilogue as, like, a really common way that, like, right, we see happily ever after as being about family, about being, you know, like, sort of in a home, like a fire burning. And I think that the thing that's also really appealing to me about, like, books with anti-heroes or, right, or is that the HEA often looks really different, right? And it's not about some external thing, like a house or kids or whatever. Often what it really boils down to is we're stronger together.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, wherever we were before and whatever we're facing in the future, we're stronger together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I think that's really beautiful.
Well, that's a lovely ending. Let's end there.
We should end there.
Thanks for listening, everyone. This was Fated Mates. Find us on Twitter at Fated Mates or on Instagram at Fated Mates Pod. Like us on your favorite podcasting app. Give us a review if you really love us. And we will be back next week with more stuff in your ear holes.